It's always hard to hear your obituary. Good evening. It's true, I was in the Rose Garden when President Clinton was 16 years old and came to the White House in, as a part of Boys Nation. And when he shook hands with President Kennedy, he decided then and there, 1963, that he wanted to be president. I tell everyone that I shook President Kennedy's hand in 1963, and I didn't think I was going to be president. I'm very honored to be here, and I must say that when I told my friends that I was going to speak at Harvard, they said, "No, not you." I confess, I know little about the law, except that all the presidents swear on a Bible before the world to uphold the law and always seem to break it, more often make end runs around it or cut corners. Richard Nixon said, "When a president does it, it's not illegal." Our leaders have found out in the past and present that no president is above the law. They do get away with a lot because secrecy is endemic in the White House and throughout the government, all governments. On the campaign trail, candidates always make big promises to have open administrations, regular news conferences. If you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you. When they get to the White House, the Iron Curtain comes down. Information that we believe belongs in the public domain becomes their private preserve, to be dispensed on their own terms, put in their thumb and pull out a plum once in a while. I believe in the people's right to know almost everything, and not to learn what happened, what really happened, in a white paper some 50 years hence. I don't know enough about your profession, but I hope that all of you who practice will have a healthy outrage against injustice. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said, "There are more lawyers in Washington than people." I do admit to some guilt playing hooky from my White House beat, because anything can happen, and usually does. Incidentally, I never waste my sympathy on presidents, and that's because I think that they have the greatest honor that can come to anyone, and that is the trust of the American people. Politics is very much in the air in the nation, and the spotlight has shifted away from the White House to the primaries being held around the country. I do have a few observations from the sidelines. For starters, I have to ask, where are the women? Their silence, the women's libbers and so forth, is deafening. Both leading Republican candidates are against choice. Can you believe that abortion is the core issue at this stage of the game, national election, with all the horrors that are going on in the world? And not enough votes really, voters really know. Not enough voters really know where the candidates stand on so many issues today. For that, I fault us. Both Texas Governor George W. Bush and Senator John McCain are against gun control. Oh, well, only 12 kids are killed every day from guns, according to the government. 5 school massacres in the last 2 years. Senator McCain is also against legislation to ban discrimination against gays. He's against equal pay for equal work. I could go on, but you get the picture. Governor Bush dubs himself a compassionate conservative. That always reminds me of a Christmas basket. With 98 executions on death row and under his watch. As for the Democrats, former Senator Bill Bradley dropped out after 18 years when the Republicans won both houses of Congress, after 40 years in the wilderness. He voted for President Reagan's tax cut, and when he headed the Finance Committee, he had no health plan. which he suddenly has developed on the campaign trail. Vice President Al Gore is carrying baggage from the 1996 re-election fundraising, that Buddhist temple, and he has tried to put some distance between himself and President Clinton. At the same time, he can share in some of the administration's triumphs: the booming economy, balanced budget, bonanza surplus. By the end of March, after the Super Tuesday primaries, we should know who the two party candidates are. Meantime, President Clinton is taking in stride the opposition candidates like Bush and McCain, who act as if the greatest insult against them would be to be compared with the president, or even called Clinton-like. The president's response is that the Republican candidates are so bereft because he says they don't have anything, any issue to run on. They do hope to make the most, however, of the morality issue. But otherwise, Clinton has trumped them with an expansive economy and his initiatives in education and health. So the president does not want to be counted out, lame duck that he is. He believes that he can get a patient's bill of rights through Congress, where your doctor and not your insurance company can decide whether you're sick or well, or how long you can stay in a hospital. He's also hoping to add prescription drugs to the Medicare program. So he's not exactly thrown in the towel, and he will sit out and will not sit out the next 11 months and do nothing, letting the rest of the world roll by. Not Clinton. He feels that he has miles to go, promises to keep before he sleeps. He will consider it a great achievement if he can get safety locks on guns for children and gun buyers to register at gun shows. As for the election, all I can say is I hope the best woman wins. No matter who wins, I hope he doesn't jog. Getting up at the crack of dawn to watch a president running in his running shorts is not my idea of fun. President Bush used to invite my younger colleagues to go jogging with him. Better them than me. I got invited to the dedication of the horseshoe pit. A few months ago, I had the honor of making a few remarks at the 75th gala birthday celebration of President Carter. And at that time, I recalled that when I was assigned to cover President-elect Jimmy Carter, I thought, oh boy, I'm going to cover a president with lust in his heart, or so he had told Playboy magazine in an interview. Well, little did I know that presidential lust was to come much later. Instead, I found myself covering a Baptist Sunday school teacher, President Carter, to an all-male class, and of course my male colleagues, the male reporters, were allowed to go into the class, and I was blocked by a big, burly bouncer. I finally convinced him I was no lady, I was a reporter. Forgive us our press passes. When I started to write my book, Front Row at the White House, might as well get in a plug, right? A Washington Post reporter called. And I told her, you know, this book is not going to sell. It has no sex in it. Then along came Monica. And it still doesn't have any sex in it. There is no doubt that the impeachment scandal tarnished the Clinton presidency and his legacy. He has paid a heavy price for his transgressions, much less selling the Lincoln bedroom for $250,000 a sleepover. But the president is a peacemaker. He is viewed with great respect as an honest broker around the world, and especially in the continuing trouble spots of the Middle East, Northern Ireland, the Balkans. He believes that history will be kinder and his legacy in better repute. He may not wind up on Mount Rushmore, but time is a great healer, and it does soften presidential images. As an afterthought, we in the press are often accused of sensationalizing the news. Hollywood could not have thought of that White House drama. It's enough to drive you to Weight Watchers. In a word or so, this is how the presidents I've covered, the eight presidents I've covered, stack up for me. Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, inspired. He had that vision thing, setting a goal to land men on the moon. He went for the first nuclear test ban treaty. He created the Peace Corps. LBJ, Johnson, brilliant on domestic issues. In his first 2 years in office, on the tailwind of the Kennedy assassination, he got through these kind of bills: Medicare, the Civil Rights Act, voting rights for blacks for the first time, public housing, the child maternal health laws. It was unbelievable, plus federal aid to education at all levels. But the Vietnam War was his denouement. President Nixon, breakthrough journey to China, first president, however, in history to be forced to resign because of the Watergate scandal. President Ford, restored confidence in the White House, stability in the country in the aftermath of the trauma of the Watergate scandal. President Carter put human rights as the centerpiece of his foreign policy. He is a great past president. President Reagan turned the country to the right. There was a Reagan revolution that still goes on. He did speed the demise of the Soviet Union with his arms buildup. President Bush, the Persian Gulf victory, Gulf War victory. All the first ladies rose to the occasion, in my opinion, once they realized where they were and that they could wave a magic wand. First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton has taken an unprecedented step of running for public office. She has a very tough opponent in New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, but she is willing to take the quantum leap, so hats off. The president is very supportive. It's payback time. When we look back on the 20th century, we realize that so many made the ultimate sacrifice for us. Two world wars, Korea, Vietnam. We also know that great breakthroughs were made in the last century in terms of civil rights, women's rights, human rights. What's more, we've made incredible high-tech robotic inroads in the 21st century. But I hope somehow we do not lose our human touch. Human beings still count. I've always felt greatly privileged to cover the White House with that ringside seat to instant history. Since there's never a day without news at the White House, and no president who has not stumbled on the way to the forum or excelled at times, there'll always be a lot to write about. Not easy at the top. Power does corrupt. We've seen it time and time again throughout our history. But it seems that once they get to the top, they should only want to do the right thing. No other place to go. I've always thought of the Oval Office as hallowed ground, a place where history is made daily. It's a place where great decisions are made in our name. Irreverence is the way we in the press play this game. Much as they covet the highest office in the land, Once they get there, presidents moan and groan about their lack of privacy, their isolation, living in the loneliest place in the world. Well, all we promised them was a rose garden. Truman, in his colorful way, called the White House the crown jewel in the penal system. Truman also had a bit of solid advice for his successors. If you want a friend in Washington, get a dog. The presidency is on-the-job training. There's no such thing as an instant president. They all have to learn the hard way. But Americans do have a lot of patience, tolerance, and understanding when it comes to the highest office in the land. As for public service and politics, well, I've decided that if you aspire to high office, you should decide at the age of 5 and live accordingly. From now on, perhaps nothing will be sacred. Politicians will be under greater scrutiny. There is a new intrusive quality in the media concerning those who aspire to lead. And if the mainstream press should decide to ignore a past foible, not likely anymore that the tabloids will let it go. But do candidates have to be, like Caesar's wife, above reproach? Or has our society become more sophisticated, less judgmental? Live and let live. Well, we'll see. Of course, public service takes a hit when scandal engulfs the White House. Turns people off? It is disillusioning. I remember during the Watergate hearings when a senator asked a young Nixon aide what he would tell any other young man who wanted to go into public service. And his reply was, "I tell him to stay away." On the positive side, a young man wrote public service down on his job application. When he was asked why, he said, "I didn't know there was an alternative." As for the press, well, we're not trying to win popularity contests. We are the self-appointed, self-anointed watchdogs of democracy. Our holy grail is the search for truth. And as it has been put so often, our mission is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. Our report card is on the front page every day. In that respect, some people think that the press has co-opted the First Amendment as our private preserve. That's not true. What is true is that we are its strongest defenders because we know it is the amendment from which all blessings flow. Freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, freedom of petition, freedom of assembly. The presidential press conference, believe it or not, is indispensable in our society because it's the only institution in our society where a president can be questioned on a regular basis and held accountable. I'm often asked how I prepare for a formal news conference. Well, first I go to the hairdresser. Your family and your friends don't care what you ask, but they want to be sure you're well-groomed. I have many memories in covering the White House. There have been times to laugh, times to cry, times to wonder. No president has ever liked the press, dating back to George Washington. I wasn't covering him, but John F. Kennedy said, "I'm reading more and enjoying it less." What LBJ said is unprintable. Once, when we walked into the cabinet room, Nixon looked up and said, "It's only coincidental that we're talking about pollution when the press walks in." President Carter always seemed to be saying, "Lord, forgive them, for they know not what they do." When President Reagan was told that the Sandinistas, the Marxists, had fired on a press helicopter at the Honduran border, he said, "There's some good in everyone." President Bush said that when he was in the White House, he believed in freedom of the press. Now he believes in freedom from the press. And when a friend asked President Clinton why the press always went along in the motorcade when he went jogging, he laughed and said, "They just want to see if I drop dead." That's true. As for memories, I remember memories. I remember when I first said, "Thank you, Mr. President," to President Kennedy. It was getting near the end of a news conference, and he was given a very tough question and kept talking, hoping to hit on the answer. Finally, I got up and I said, "Thank you, Mr. President." He said, "Thank you, Helen." And I remember when we were watching President Carter on a Christmas day as he played on the front porch in Plains, Georgia with his grandchildren, and he was obviously playing for the cameras. His youngest son, Jeff, walked over to us, and the cameraman said, "Don't you feel sorry for your dad, the burdens, press always watching?" "No," Jeff said, "he asked for it." And I remember when Kennedy told us an off-the-cuff remark at a news conference, "Life is unfair." And I remember asking him at Georgetown Hospital when John was born if he wanted his son to grow up to be president. He said, "I just want him to be healthy." And I remember on Air Force One when we asked Kennedy, "What would happen if the aircraft crashed?" "I know one thing," he said, "your name will be just a footnote." And I remember when President Johnson invited us to the LBJ Ranch for dinner, and he asked Bill Moyers, who had been a Baptist minister, was then his press secretary, to say grace. Moyers bent his head, began to pray. Johnson commanded, "Speak up, Bill." "I wasn't talking to you, Mr. President," Moyers replied. And I remember when President Johnson went to Bethesda Naval Hospital for gallbladder surgery. The psychiatric ward had been transformed into a press room. What happened to the patients?" Johnson asked Moyers. "We gave them all press cards," said Moyers. And I remember when a rabbi spoke at the Martin Luther King March on Washington in 1963, and he said that the greatest sin of all in the Nazi era was silence. And I remember when President Nixon gave a farewell dinner for Chief Justice Earl Warren, the same Warren that he had denounced on the campaign trail, Warren Court, and so forth. Warren got up, raised his glass, and got up and said, "I leave with malice in my heart toward none." And I remember when Attorney General John Mitchell said in the Watergate era, "Watch what we do, not what we say." And I remember Martha Mitchell, who said, "Politics is a dirty business." And I remember when President Reagan went to Moscow for a summit meeting with Mikhail Gorbachev. Suddenly, the evil empire was no more in Reagan's eyes. And he noted that the Russians laughed and they cried and they were human. When we got back to Washington, I said to him, "Mr. President, do you think maybe if you had gone to Moscow 10 years ago, 20 years ago, you might have found out. They laugh, they cry, they're human." "No," he said, "they've changed." And I remember when President Ford said that if God had created the world in 6 days, on the seventh day he could not have rested. He would have had to explain it to Helen Thomas. And I hope I would have been asking God my favorite question, why? I remember going to a Christmas party at Sam Donaldson's house a few years ago. On that very day, the Washington Post said that General Colin Powell was going to become Clinton's Secretary of State. Powell was at the party, and in my usual shy way, I marched up to him and I said, "General, are you going to become the next Secretary of State?" To which he turned to another guest and said, "Isn't there some war we can send her to?" Well, nothing ventured, nothing gained. I remember Midge Costanza, who said, "I don't mind Carter being born again, but did he have to come back as himself?" And I remember asking Billy Carter if he too had been born again. He said, "Once is enough." And then there was my all-time favorite, Miss Lillian, President Carter's mother, who said, "Sometimes when I look at my children, I wish I'd remained a virgin." On the day that Carter was elected president, a reporter ran up to Miss Lillian and said, "Aren't you proud of your son?" She said, "Which one?" When I interviewed her in 1976 in Plains, she was still fuming over a French woman correspondent who had belabored Carter's campaign promise never to lie. She kept asking Miss Lillian, "What do you really mean by that?" Finally, she said to Miss Lillian, "Do you lie?" Miss Lillian said, "Well, might tell a little white lie." "Well, what do you mean by a little white lie?" In total exasperation, Miss Lillian said, "You remember when you came through that door and I told you how beautiful you looked? Well, that's a little white lie." And then there was Henry Kissinger, a man with a mammoth ego. A woman ran up to Kissinger and said, "Oh, Dr. Kissinger, thank you for saving the world." He said, "You're welcome." When Kissinger teased his Secret Service agents that he might be kidnapped by terrorists, they told him, "Don't worry, we'll never let them take you alive." I always think of newspapers as shared pain, sometimes shared horror. Just as Brandeis said, that a constant spotlight on public officials lessens the possibility of corruption. He also said that if the government becomes a lawbreaker, it breeds contempt for the law. Lincoln said, "Let the people know the facts, the country will be safe." Jefferson said, "Eternal vigilance is the price of liberty." Engraved in the mantel in the state dining room at the White House is a prayer by John Adams which says, "May only good and wise men live here." We all hope for that, and I believe that people can handle the truth, and they deserve no less, and we should keep an eye on presidents who have life and death power over all humanity today to keep the people informed and democracy alive. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
We do have time for a few questions, and again, if we would do that by writing those on note cards and passing them to the forum members that are gathering those, I would read one more passage from Ms. Thomas. Answer. Where did you come from, Mars? So,
that's right.
Hopefully that's not in this stack so far. First question, given your criticisms of the four leading candidates, who is your ideal candidate for president?
If elected, I will. I will serve. I shouldn't be so harsh on the candidates. They're the only ones we got, right? I just want people to know what each one stands for. One can never assume that they will change in the White House, per se. Some may, some may not. I remember when President Johnson, who had been Senate Majority Leader, and of course he came from the South, basically Southwest Texas, and he was not a great promoter of civil rights in the Senate. He was a compromiser. He had to walk that line. But when he became president, a group of Southern senators came to him and said, what do you mean by all this Civil Rights Act, voting rights, and so forth? You didn't do that? You didn't say these things in the Senate? And President Johnson said, "I'm president now, president of all the people." You always hope that whoever becomes president will really grow in office. And I am amazed at the harshness and the bitterness that I've seen in these primaries. catfights almost, and it's kind of unbelievable. And you don't really, well, I think the Democrats are debating the issues more than the Republicans at this time, but that may change. It will have to change. But I say know what you're voting for, or who you're voting for, and what he stands for.
Question from Felicity Spector of the Channel 4 News Leader, or Channel 4 News in Loudoun, excuse me. Is the 24-hour news cycle and the pressure of constant deadlines going to drive down the quality of political journalism because the race to be first overwhelms the desire to be best?
Well, there is certainly a certain amount of pressure. I know that when the Monica Lewinsky story broke, the 24-hour cable companies moved on to the north lawn of the White House, and we used to call it Monica Beach. I would go to the gate, try to go out to get a sandwich, and I would be grabbed to be interviewed. I mean, they did have to fill that cycle. But I think everything's sort of calmed down now, and there's a different story, a different game. But no, I just think that there are other obstacles. I like the fact that people are getting news almost by osmosis. I do regret that we have become a country of one newspaper towns, because competition really is a lifeblood for reporters. And I can remember certainly when New York had at least 12 papers. Every major city had at least 3 papers. Isn't that right? My colleague here from UPI. So it's kind of sad. But I hope that all of you somehow can find the time to read newspapers. At least every day something, and read the news magazines. Because that's the first draft of history, and you'll have a leg up when you get out into the working world. You will know what's going on.
Compare and contrast your feelings at each event and your coverage of each event, of these events. Nixon's resignation press conference, Clinton's response to Lewinsky, LBJ's taking the reins after JFK's death, and Kennedy's Cuban Missile Conference.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is no joy in the fall from grace of any president. So for at least 6 months longer at the White House in the press room, it was darkness at noon, because we knew that nothing President Nixon could do could change the dynamics. It was his fate. His doom was as inexorable as a Greek tragedy. So it was very, very painful to watch his swan song, his farewell address. We were all pained, and we knew how much the family was suffering. And the last news conferences, you have to know the presidents very seldom hold news conferences when things are going bad. And they usually go underground. Clinton didn't hold a news conference for 9 months during the last scandal, and Nixon went 5 months, but we keep putting the pressure on, say they have to be accountable, and eventually they do. So it was very, very tough to ask Nixon the questions that you knew were sealing his fate. On Clinton's response to Lewinsky, well, I'm sure that in the Monday morning quarterbacking, that he must have a lot of regrets for the way he handled the whole situation. And having sullied the Oval Office, not knowing where he was, really, and submitting to the way of all flesh, the temptations. I'm sure that he must have a lot of regrets. But on the other hand, I was astonishing the way he was able to compartmentalize, keep going, carry on his presidential duties. This man, this president, has never known 1 second in the White House when he has not been investigated. His enemies hate him viscerally. When you ask them, what is it that you don't really like, they can't tell you. So he has lived under that kind of human dynamics throughout his presidency. LBJ took over like a man, took over the presidency like a man who had trained for it all of his life. He was bigger than life. He understood the presidency, and he understood that he had to do something, and he was the can-do man. And I think that's why Kennedy knew. You know, I think it's one of the unfortunate things in our system that one man really can pick, so far, a future president, because it's the candidate who really picks his running mate. And since I've been in Washington, let's see, Truman, Johnson, Ford. Three vice presidents have become president. Actually, I was there with FDR, so it was four. And so the question is the roll of the dice that a vice president can become president. So I think a lot of thought should always be given. Can this, is this man up to the job? And I don't think that's often done. But in the case of Johnson, Kennedy knew that Johnson was a big man on campus, that he was capable of doing anything, and that he certainly was a great legislator. My favorite story about Johnson, apropos of nothing, it was during the Vietnam War when the protests were beginning to divide the country, split the country in half, really. And some of the lawmakers who had been with him and supported the war were beginning to change their minds, and were talking about that, you know, Senator Aiken of Vermont said we should declare a victory and leave. If they had taken that advice, they would have been much better off, both Johnson and Nixon. But Frank Church was senator from Idaho, and he was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And he was beginning to become very disillusioned with the war and beginning to think maybe the U.S. Should not be going 10,000 miles away to bomb a country. And Johnson gave a reception at the White House, and Church was there. He called over Senator Church, and he said, do you people know who Walter Lippmann was? He's a great political analyst in the 40s, 30s, 50s. Johnson asked Senator Church, just where do you get your ideas about Vietnam? And Senator Church said, from Walter Lippmann, the political columnist. So Johnson said, well, next time you meet a dam in Idaho, you just ask Walter Lippmann. So he knew where the bodies were buried, and he knew every man's price. Kennedy's Cuban Missile Crisis. There is no question that Kennedy learned a lot in the Bay of Pigs, and so he was up to the Cuban Missile Crisis. He was ready for crisis. He had learned a lot. He grew in office, and he knew the chips were down. I'll always be grateful to Nikita Khrushchev for the courage of cowardice. I was so happy that he pulled those missiles out, because Kennedy could not retreat again after the Bay of Pigs.
Related question, could you say a few words about your experience during the Cuban Missile Crisis and your reactions to the degree of secrecy involved in the decision-making process?
Well, I was amazed at Washington, because we really felt we were in the eye of the hurricane. There was no panic in the town, but we knew that there was a possibility that somebody might push a button. So we went about our business, and at one point Kennedy came out of the very high-powered meetings, and he was asked, you know, how are things going? He said, it's been a very interesting day. So they weren't saying much, and I suppose in terms of nuclear war, some secrecy probably was justified. But thank goodness for communications, teletypes, and a newspaper man who was very instrumental in being a go-between. His name was John Scali. He used to be an AP reporter, and then he worked for ABC.
couple of related questions. Why do you think the American press gave so much importance to the Clinton-Lewinsky issue rather than other more important domestic and international issues? Many other countries could not understand why the press became so Puritan and went beyond to ridicule their own president. And a related question, you opened a news conference with Tony Blair and Bill Clinton with a question about the Monica Lewinsky scandal. What would you say to those who criticize that as inappropriate?
Well, I don't think anything's inappropriate. There are no bad questions, only lousy answers. On the question of why the Lewinsky scandal, the president had a special prosecutor I likened to Inspector Javert in Les Miserables. He was relentless. He turned whitewater. He moved right into the sex scandal, per se. But it ceased to be sex. It was an impeachment of a president. And that's why it got such great coverage, because this was a move to remove a president of the United States from office. And that's the story we covered. I think there were incredible mistakes made on all sides, but the report on the scandal to the House Judiciary Committee was deliberately written for Hustler magazine, probably, and without sanitizing it or anything else. And Ken Starr had it written that way, which I think was unbelievable. The Judiciary Committee, without even reading it, dumped it on the internet, and the rest is history. So I really wonder how that could have happened, but we were covering an impeachment. We weren't covering a sex scandal. And I think when a president of the United States is on the ropes, you sure have to write it.
Why was the press's reaction to Kennedy's infidelity so different from... Clinton's infidelity?
The world has changed. Maybe you haven't noticed. We've had a sexual revolution. We've had a cultural revolution. People are different. In the old days, I'll grant you, there was a basic gentleman's code that you did not write about the private lives of politicians per se unless what they did impacted on their responsibilities and duties officially. If you follow a fan dancer into the tidal basin and wind up on a police blotter, we would have written it and did. That actually happened. I know you're too young for that, but the world has changed. All the rules are out the window. Anybody who wants a private life should not go into public life. That doesn't mean that all the skeletons in your closet will be revealed, but there's always that chance, because we want to know more and more these days, the total scrutiny of the people who want to lead us.
What role do you feel the student or college press has to play in the coverage of national or even local politics? That question from Frank Dubet.
I hope they'll play with the total role, because I think it's very, very important. You're the future voters. You are the people who are going to run this country. And I would like to see total involvement and total interest. And what better than the college press?
A couple more questions if there are no others coming forward. President Clinton was recently ranked 21st of the 41 presidents in a survey of historians. Do you agree with that assessment? And where would you rank Clinton?
Well, I don't like this ranking business, because I think we all have our own ideas of what would make a good president. So, and I also do think that, you know, when President Truman left Washington, only a couple officials, his Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, and a couple of others saw him off at the train station. There were trains then. His popularity polls were 23%. That's about as low as you can get. But in the ensuing years, as people began to realize what he did and his tremendous decisions in the post-war, World War II era. Very, very courageous decisions. His stature has grown immensely. So I think it's very bad to make these kind of judgments so quickly in the whole panorama of presidents. I think Clinton's going to wind up pretty good, of course, except for the Lewinsky scandal. But he's done a lot of good. He has brought about a rosy economy, no question about that. He did balance the budget. He has had a surplus. He has worked for peace throughout his presidency. He's not a man of war.
I have a few more questions. We'll do exactly two more, if that's okay. Do you think TV coverage of press conferences helps or harms the press in securing full openness in covering the presidency?
I like TV because I think that people have the great advantage that way of seeing a president, hearing his words, making up their own minds. So the more people are exposed to the real thing, the better off. And we are but a transmission belt, so it's good. Televised news conferences are good.
We'll close with this question. When there are no papers, news via the net, better or worse? So news via the internet, what do you think about that?
When there are no papers, I'll take the news wherever I can get it. Do you think Hillary Clinton will win? It's another question. I think she has a good chance. I think it's very, very, it's very, very tough. And one of the phenomena of this election is that she's having a hard time getting white women to support her. Frankly, I would have thought that the women's libbers would be for her, but somehow the carpetbagger albatross seems to be still there. Rise of cable television has transformed me. We had that. You believe that the freedom of speech is often abused? No. Why? I believe in freedom. I might. Who was it? Voltaire who said, "I may not agree with you, but I certainly would fight with my life your right to say what you believe." Why do you think the American press gave much more importance to the Clinton-Lewinsky issue? Oh, we did that, didn't we? So I guess I've covered the waterfront, huh? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thomas.